I will call the remote hearing of the Environment and Natural Resources Conference Committee to order. Today is May 12, 2022. This meeting is held in accordance with Rule 10.01, which was passed and allows for remote hearings. All remote hearings are recorded and live streamed by House Public Information. The clerk will take attendance by roll.
Chair Hansen is present. Representative Wasilek?
Wasilek present.
Representative Morrison? Representative Morrison? Representative Lippert?
Lippert present.
Representative Heintzman?
Heintzman present.
Chair Ingebrigtsen?
Chair present.
Looks like we're waiting on a few others. Senator Tomassoni? Senator Eichhorn? Senator Weber? And Senator Eakin. Thank you.
Chair Ingebrigtsen, do you want us to recess and wait, or what would you like to do?
No, I'm just go right ahead. I know you got some information here today, and I think you'll find them coming on here. We're on the floor, as you know, so you just go right ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Ingebrigtsen. And members, we have some testifiers today. We've been trying to get the Metropolitan Council on, I think, is this after 3 days, Senator Ingebrigtsen. So they are here, and I have Sam Paskey with the Metropolitan Council Environmental Services is here to present their portion of the bill. So welcome, Mr. Paskey, and if you could state your name and who you're with for the record.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Sam Paskey, Assistant General Manager for the Environmental Services Division of the Met Council. And I'll just use a little bit of your valuable time today. I'm thankful for it. The Met Council partners with local government, and that is the context for this provision that the governor has asked for addressing climate risk to infrastructure. In our work with local governments, our partners have expressed a need for improved information and decision-making support in order to be better prepared for flooding or power outages. I think the timing of this really worked out quite well, actually.
Did it ever.
Right, destructive winds. I wrote this, by the way, not yesterday or today, and other events to reduce risks to water, wastewater, transportation, energy, stormwater conveyance, and other government and public safety services. This funding is simply to use to work with local communities and watersheds to better understand and reduce that local infrastructure risk, which also includes risks to private property from extreme weather by targeting projects and disaster planning efforts to reduce that risk. We just know we have more risk than we can afford, and we're trying to bring together a group of stakeholders at the local level to help guide ways to prioritize that limited funding so it has the best impact on both the infrastructure, but on the health and safety of the people in the metro area. That's the short version. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe Mr. Stanley or Ms. Taylor can tell me on the side-by-side what area the Met Council is involved in the side-by-side, what article and where?
Mr. Stanley or Ms. Taylor?
Mr. Chair, there are some appropriations to Met Council that start on R21 of Article 1 on the House side. I believe that's what they were referring to. Then there are the paragraph A is the appropriation from the governor's recommendation, and the House had some additional ones on R22 and R23.
Thank you.
Ms. Taylor, could you maybe just highlight the inflow infiltration on 20.3 and the subsequent Met Council portions.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members, the paragraph B starting on 20.3 would provide 2.5 million for inflow and infiltration. These would be grants for 50% of the costs of the publicly owned. And then paragraph C starting on 20.28 would provide similar financial assistance to private property owners.
And it's paragraph D, lead service lines.
Paragraph D would provide 2.335 million for the lead service lines, and then paragraph C, 2.5 million for the Metro Council's regional parks. And then F on the bottom of R23, would be more for the regional parks. This is from the lottery and lieu money.
So that is not general fund, that's natural resources fund.
Right, yeah.
And that's not from an addition dependent on changing the formula of lottery and lieu of that's amount that's there now. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Members, any questions? I think the lead service lines are really important potentially to match federal dollars coming in. I want to be clear because there was a letter stating about this was not including Greater Minnesota. So the Public Facilities Authority is not within our jurisdiction, Senator Ingebrigtsen, but the Met Council Environmental Services is. So that's why this appropriation is here. Seeing no questions, thank you, Mr. Paskey. Thank you for being here, and we'll move to the next topic area. And I know we want to be talking a little bit about trees. So maybe if Ms. Taylor could highlight areas in the side-by-side where there are emerald ash borer or other tree-related proposals.
Mr. Chair, you'll have to give me a minute here. Or if Mr. Hagemeyer, he might be more familiar with the appropriations.
Mr. Hagemeyer.
Mr. Chair, yep, I can point you to the forestry tree-related provisions. If you just give me 1 second, pull them up. Again, you'll be looking at the Article 1 side-by-side, starting on R14, on the house side, it'd be lines 12.18. There's 10.15 million the second year for grants for local governments for to replace trees and to remove and address emerald ash borer. And then you'll see another provision for $1 million on R15. There's $1 million starting on house side, lines 13.9. There's $1 million for grants for pre-kindergarten to grade 12 schools for tree planting activities. And then those are the two direct ones in the DNR. And then under Board of Water and Soil Resources, there's a appropriation. I believe it's the last appropriation in there for Board of Water and Soil Resources. Yes, on page R20 of Article 1 side-by-side, there's on the House side 18.32, there's $8 million the second year for accelerated conservation tree planting. It's a one-time appropriation, and then you'll see towards the end on R21, there's a carve-out of that 500 must be used to address invasive species via cooperative weed management agreements. And those are the direct tree-related provisions in the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if members from the DNR could respond to a couple questions related to emerald ash borer.
Ms. Lothammer or Mr. Bowe?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lippert, Forrest Bowe, Director of DNR Forestry here.
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Bowe. Thanks for being here. So I was just looking at the DNR Community Tree Survey from 2010 and noticing the percentage of trees in communities across the state that are ash trees. And just in the A's, we had Ada, Norman County, in Northwest Minnesota with 23% ash in their canopy, Adams and Moore County in Southeast Minnesota with 44% ash, Adrian and Nobles County in Southwest Minnesota's 32% ash. Can you just talk a little bit about the percentage of ash trees or how prevalent ash trees are in communities in Minnesota?
Director Ball.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lippert, ash are very prominent in our communities and really all over Minnesota. We have over a billion ash trees in Minnesota. A lot of those, of course, are in our black ash swamps in northern Minnesota. But, you know, years ago we had a lot of elm in our communities, and elm died off because of Dutch elm disease. And so communities were aggressive to plant ash. I'm hoping this time around we plant a much more diverse urban forest so that we don't get into this trouble again. But we have a lot of our communities are packed with ash.
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Bowe. Yeah, that's helpful. And I'm hopeful that we'll have a more diverse representation of trees as we go forward too. Now I've heard from city leaders in Northfield as we are starting to deal with emerald ash borer here. We have some trees that are being removed right now that these costs are just really hard on the city budget. City leaders really don't quite know what to do. Do you have a sense of you know what it costs to remove and replace an ash tree and what cities are facing? Is what's happening in Northfield pretty consistent across the state?
Director Ball.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lippert, I think what's happening in Northfield is very consistent with what's happening across the state. We have EAB in 34 counties now across the state. From what I'm seeing, we have the removal of the ash tree is actually the most expensive part. So I think communities are paying about $1,000 per tree, about $800 is for removal and $200 for replacement, something like that is some of the last facts and figures I've seen. I would also say that, you know, we've had some grant programs funded through the legislature in the past. And it's always 2-to-1, twice as many requests for twice as much money than what we've been able to fund just year after year.
Representative Lippert.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Bowe. So I'm hearing very high demand that grant funds are being put to good use, and there's very, very high demand as well. One of our House provisions is providing $10 million for grants to local governments to replace trees removed to address emerald ash borer. And you know, I think one of my concerns is what happens if these grant funds aren't made available as city governments are needing to address this issue. You know, what happens when city governments are behind on addressing removal of dead ash trees, or like what are we seeing already as city governments are behind is maybe another way to ask it.
Director Ball.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lippert, what we're hearing from the cities is, well, of course, they don't have the funding to remove the ash or replace the ash within their own city budgets. So I think you know, for one, it's really tough on a city's budget when you're faced with this many ash trees at these kinds of costs. I would also say that the ash doesn't stand very long after it's been attacked by the emerald ash borer. So they get very brittle fairly quick, and they start to fall down on homes, on cars, on fences, creating even more issues for the communities and private landowners.
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for that, Mr. Bowe. So I'm hearing a dangerous situation if we have dead ash trees and cities don't have the resources to be able to address them in a timely fashion. I think my final comment is just that I think it makes good sense to provide some one-time dollars for these sorts of grants for communities. They will be put to good use, and the state needs to be a strong partner here in helping communities deal with emerald ash borer and replace these trees. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Ball.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for Mr. Bowe. Mr. Bowe, what's the regulation on disposal of the ash tree if they're in the boulevard or in on private property? And are there any public-private partnerships for removal? Has there been any of that? If there's no regulation on disposal, I'm an old tree cutter myself and used to burn a lot of wood. However, I don't think I burned any emerald ash borer wood. Can you talk a little bit about that? That's going on.
Director Ball.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, disposal of the ash is a big issue for communities. I know some communities are trying to burn the ash for energy. Some are doing open burning, and some are trying to make use of that resource for a lot of other things. Think back when we had the elm issue here in Minnesota. We mandated the use of that elm for all of our sound barrier fencing in the Twin Cities. A really good use, novel approach for using that material, making something worthwhile out of it. Disposal is a huge issue. There are some very small, what I would call niche things, partnerships happening, but nothing at a big enough level to address the disposal issue. And again, I just want to reiterate that the removal of those trees is the largest cost for the communities and the landowners.
Sure.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
No, I'm good. Thank you.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate Director Bowe's comments, and my question may be directed to him or perhaps someone else from DNR. This strikes me as a fairly apocalyptic situation that we're facing, 1 billion ash trees. I mean, it's sort of an unfathomable number. I remember the Dutch elm disease crisis when I was a kid. We know a lot more about climate change and the role that trees have in helping us to address that. I'm wondering if someone can speak to what some of the other implications are if we don't address this crisis, if we don't invest in removing these diseased trees and then plant replacement ones. I was thinking about this last night even, sorry, Mr. Chair, with our storm last night, and it sounds like we might have similar ones tomorrow. What would the implications be when we continue to have these very heavy precipitation events if we have that 1 billion fewer trees?
Director Bolt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Morrison for the question. You know, ash trees provide a ton of benefits in our communities. They provide shade that reduces our heat impact. They reduce our storm water. So they're sucking up storm water And if you think about just a community that has a lot less trees, of course, you're going to have more stormwater to treat. And I think the livability of communities decreases too, just the desire to be living in that community. So communities are a real, you know, sense of place. If we think about ash in our forests, if we lose those ash, we'll be facing a lot of water issues. Those ash are, of course, lowland black ash species. They take up a lot of water. So the whole water table in our forest ecosystem is probably going to come up, and no place for that to be absorbed. Of course, the ash are huge areas where we store carbon or have wildlife habitat. So there's all kinds of implications of one of our main species dying off.
Follow up, Representative Morrison, or?
Thank you, Director Bow. So Director Bow, would you encourage us to remove and then replant trees, given your comments?
Director Bow.
Chair Hansen, Representative Morrison, well, of course, I'm the director of forestry. We would encourage more tree planting anywhere, and certainly the removal and replanting of our urban trees is important.
Thank you.
Representative Wasilek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director Bow, for being here. One thing that you mentioned that I sort of popped a question into my mind was the point about the shade that trees provide and sort of what that means in terms of heat. And I think one of the things we're also looking at with regards to the way the climate is changing is more extreme heat. And that has particularly negative impacts on urban communities with the heat island effect and sort of all those factors, less green space, that sort of thing. Do you know of any sort of research out there, anything that talks more about, like, if there are fewer trees, like how many degrees things go up? I'm just sort of interested in what that impact would be in a place like the Twin Cities if all of a sudden a bunch of trees are missing.
Director Bow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wasilek, I don't know of that offhand. I'm sure there's something. I can kind of picture reading about it in years past. But I could get back to you on that. If you think about those heat islands, it's degrees, right? Not tenths of degrees. It's degrees.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director, for that answer. I would love to receive that information. I think one of the things that we sort of have to remember in these discussions is that in a lot of our urban communities, we have low-income folks and other vulnerable people living in the urban communities, and so they're already impacted by the health impacts of things like pollution and climate change, and so wanting to ensure that we're also protecting the health of folks by ensuring that if we do have a bunch of trees that we have to remove, that we are replacing those trees to make sure we're not making things worse. So thank you.
Director Bow.
Yes, we can, Mr. Chair, Representative Walsworth, we can get that information. There's a program by the U.S. Forest Service called iTrees, and so I think we'll be able to get that to you fairly quickly. I just don't have it at my fingertips here today.
Director Bow, I have a question about kind of urgency. You know, last year we passed a temporary extension for district energy to be receiving ash trees and other wood waste, but that doesn't last very long. And so, and even anecdotally, I've heard that they are above anticipated just because of the number of storm damage, but also the number of ash trees that have to come down, that are coming down in communities, and that this is throughout a wide area of taking those trees. Could you maybe talk about ultimate, you know, because if it goes to a city compost area, it still has to go somewhere else. I think this is what Senator Ingebrigtsen was getting to. Where do we go with them after we've taken them down, particularly if we cannot go to district energy in a couple of years?
So, Mr. Chair, there are communities that are just open burning the ash. There's an opportunity to use some of the ash for energy. Again, there's small niche operations that could use some of the ash for maybe some lumber and some wood products. But we really do need to find that longer term solution for massive quantities. I will say that whatever we can do to slow it down allows us to meter things out a little bit. And as I recall, a couple of years ago, I think in an LCCMR appropriation, communities were allowed to treat some of the ash trees with a non-neonicotinoid. And what that does is it just lengthens out the process and allows a community to keep some of those ash while kind of metering out the other ones that are dying. And I think that that was a really good idea. We need to think about ways to spread this out over a longer period of time.
If I remember correctly, though, that is a delay to deal with the volume, which is becoming huge. And with the storm damage, we've got down trees or trees that are about to be coming down, you know, with more aggressive storms. So the district energy option isn't going to be there very long. And, and maybe we get a PCA addressed. We can't really landfill this waste and the consequences of burning this many trees in the open adds to climate challenges, but also air quality and soot, et cetera. I see Senator Ingebrigtsen has a question, so I'll go to him.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bowe, last year there were some appropriations, I think 2.4 during the budget year, $2.4 million from the general fund and $1 million added onto that for disposal. How is that sitting so far with the budget for being midterm here?
Director Bowe.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, all of those grants have been awarded. Everywhere from Aiken to Apple Valley and Lakeville to Lamberton and Mankato to Moorhead, communities have received grants all across the state. And so all of that funding is now out the door and in the community's hands to replace, do an inventory, to manage their ash, to do the removal and to replace those ash trees in various communities.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
No, thank you.
I think this is a good example of, you know, we may be in the middle of the biennium, but the demand is so high that it's already used up. And if there's one-time money, the need is still there rather than waiting another year. Are there any other questions? I had a question about the nursery capacity. I don't know if Ms. Lotthammer is there or Representative Lippert, did you have any other questions on trees?
I do, Mr. Chair, but I want to ask Director Jaski some questions about trees so I can let you ask about the nursery.
Ms. Lotthammer, just kind of the question on capacity, or Assistant Commissioner Lotthammer, excuse me, the capacity on the nursery and to respond and to trees.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. And Shannon Lotthammer, Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Natural Resources. And one of the divisions that I work with is the Division of Forestry. And I'll invite Director Bowe to add anything that I might miss as well. But to your question, Mr. Chair, so the State Forest Nursery currently has the capacity to produce about 4 million tree seedlings, conservation grade tree seedlings each year. Thanks to an appropriation from the legislature last year, we're in the process of ramping up that production level with a goal of getting closer to 5 million each year. So because we do have a statutory cap of 10 million trees, actually 10 million trees per year. So we're looking to ramp up to 6 million trees a year. And we're in the process of doing that. We also have been, you know, encouraging local nurseries and private nurseries to increase their capacity for growing trees and tree seedlings, because we know that even with ramping up the production at the State Forest Nursery, we're not going to be able to meet the projected demand for the amount of trees that are needed, both because of the replacement that's needed because of emerald ash borer, but then also to meet the needs for reforestation efforts that Minnesotans are interested in, and then also to make shifts to tree species that may be a little bit more resilient to some of the effects that we're seeing from changing weather patterns and things like that.
So Commissioner Lotthammer, to with the $10 million, we're not going to be able to put small whip trees into the boulevards. We'll have to go to the private market to get trees, diverse trees, resilient trees. So the Nursery and Landscape Association, the local nursery, that's where we're going to have to go, communities, to get these trees. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, yes. I think most communities, especially if they're replacing boulevard trees, or, you know, if residents are replacing a large ash tree, they don't necessarily, like you said, want the 16-inch, 18-inch seedling. They're looking for those potted trees or those bald and burlap trees, and that's really the purview of the private nurseries.
So this would be money that could go out into the economy, those private nurseries, and then it's used in the local communities. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's certainly what we've seen with the grants that have gone out and the trees that have been purchased up to now.
So Senator Ingebrigtsen, the ash trees that came down in my yard haven't been replaced yet, so I planted some giant sunflowers there and hopefully they come up this year. But
They certainly won't sustain the wind, I'll tell you that.
No, but they're faster.
They're faster, yeah. You won't get a lot of shade either, but they're pretty.
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Jashke is available to just answer some questions about the accelerated conservation planting provision.
Let me just make sure, as he's getting ready, Senator Ingebrigtsen, or did any of your folks want to have any questions of Commissioner Lotthammer?
Okay. Not seeing any, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll just note also that we have some ash trees coming down in Northfield right now, and community members are disappointed. So I know that the bigger trees we can have for replacement, the better. Director Jashke, I want to ask you, we have a provision on the House side for accelerated conservation plantings, and we've had some conversation in the past about small woodlots and across the state. I know as I drive along country roads and see small woodlots at farmsteads and other spots, many don't look like they're in the best shape. It seems like there's some opportunities for replanting and helping restore some of those woodlots. I'm wondering if you could talk more about small woodlots and some of the opportunities there might be for conservation plantings.
Yes,
Dr. Jashke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative John Jashke, Executive Director of the Board of Water and Soil Resources. So there are a number of various tree-based conservation practices that really don't on forestry, because we're not talking about forest ecosystems, we're talking about planting trees in much smaller plots, typically, as Representative Liberty just described. Most of them, maybe all of them, actually are prescribed through longstanding practices that have been established through the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Natural Resources Conservation Service, and the Forest Service is also does some of those, and they coordinate many of those things. So I'll highlight four practices that are used commonly: shelter belts and windbreaks, which provide energy conservation and erosion control. Right, those are really important. We used to see a lot more of those, but they were often planted along building areas and homesteads, and also on field borders. Right, and as those trees either aged out and you know, disintegrated, or in some cases the field boundaries were removed because the equipment, things were larger, those trees were went away. They were designed and spec'd to block wind. They were also designed and spec'd to provide some, you know, habitat for various species, birds, of course, of various kinds. But the other two practices are in a little bit more natural setting, and that would be a floodplain replanting. You know, our floodplains for the different tree species would fit into those compared to some of the other practices. But they're important because the trees, you know, are what kind of grow there and hold that soil together, right? And sometimes there's grasses and things as well, but a floodplain forest is a really important part of our ecosystem. It allows that water to move across the landscape without harm and come back into the river at some point downstream. The other one is riparian forest buffers, where you actually use tree plantings along a stream. And this is true in more forested areas as well as in some of the lesser ones, to provide, in essence, the same kind of thing you could do with grass. Only the tree planting does some of the same things and something additional, including some of the kind of benefits. So that's kind of a strip along a river or stream, that sort of thing. Providing shaded stream, you know, habitat for the fish and things like that is also important. And then finally, I'll mention the woodlots that you just described. There's also, you know, we've had a lot of disease. You've heard about Dutch elm, of course, now with the ash, right? You know, and replanting those woodlots that are privately owned is something that we use the DNR expertise on, as they have the private foresters who can help write stewardship plans, and then landowners bring their own money and expertise and often labor and equipment, along with, you know, some supply that comes from, typically it comes from the local soil and water conservation district, right? They use private nurseries to, like, they just, you know, most of them just did this, you know, a week or so ago. I delivered those trees that were ordered earlier in the year. The DNR nursery also provides some of those, kind of as the, this isn't exactly the right word, but the leftovers. DNR uses the things that they need to reestablish the state forest, but then if there are additional seedlings available, they make those available for the soil and water conservation districts. But for the most part, they rely on the private sector nurseries to provide those seedlings and bigger plants as well, depending on what the individual landowners are interested in. And most of those are either then spec'd with one of those conservation plans I talked about, or if it's a larger area, stewardship plan will be accomplished through the DNR's forestry expertise.
Tom Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Director Jashke, for that. You know, one thing I'm very interested in is planting trees for the climate benefit, as Representative Morrison was mentioning, but also recognizing the many other benefits that the planting trees have for habitat, other, you know, other benefits for a homestead, et cetera. I heard you outlining many of those. I was also interested in just asking you to say more about the technical assistance that is provided to private landowners. You were talking about that some, and I wonder if you could just mention the technical assistance and support that would be provided landowners so that they're doing what's best for their property and doing this in the best way.
Yeah, good question, Mr. Chair and members. I shall also add one more practice that's a little less common, but also very important, and that is living snow fences. The Department of Transportation works with soil and water conservation districts and private landowners to identify places where they can plant trees, typically in rows, to provide snow windbreaks to, you know, prevent the snow from piling onto our state highway, right, for safety reasons. So safety is also another consideration in some of these tree practices. But to your question, Representative Lippert, I would say there's basically three sources. You know, again, depending on the kind of conservation practice that's warranted, if it's a shelter belt or a windbreak, those types of practices, or a snow protection area, or even a recurring buffer, those are typically handled by the standard spec book that the USDA has provided through the NRCS, and that would be using the Soil and Water Conservation District staff, possibly some federal staff as well. If it's a larger area and the landowner is looking at a broader set of conditions, including potentially some harvesting once the trees are mature and then replanting and so forth, there's, DNR has a program that provides a stewardship plan to those landowners, right? And they either DNR directly or through private foresters as well, who also are contracted to do this work, they can help a landowner with a larger parcel, maybe, you know, 20 40 acres, something like that, right? And so that's also available through those different channels. And they typically start with a local soil and water district, and then they determine which of the types of things the landlord is interested in and which fit their property, and then bring in the expertise that would match the landowner's needs and the site's needs.
Tim Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Those are my main questions for this provision. I just think this is another area where we could be planting trees, meeting the interests of landowners across our state who are interested in enhancing their properties just getting more trees on the landscape in a smart way. I have some other questions about some other provisions of Director Jashke, but I'll stop for now.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
So, Mr. Chair, maybe a point of clarity here, Mr. Chair. Are we supplying funding for private tree growers, or are we talking about publicly owned boulevards, public property, things like that?
I believe, I think that would be a question to both Director Jashke and Director Bowe, but I think the issue is, like with boulevards, in order to get the trees, you got to buy them from the private sector. So the city is buying them from the private sector, but Director Jashke and Director Bowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'll go first then. So Senator Ingerson's question, yes, these are the practices I was talking about, the windbreaks and shelter belts and buffers. Those are provided to private landowners. These are all on private lands, and they have the cost sharing agreement, right, which is statutorily authorized. So the landowner puts in a portion, the public dollars pay for the other portion. And then, as Representative Rupert indicated, you know, some technical assistance typically comes from the Soil and Water Conservation District of the DNR, or private foresters to also write these stewardship plans, right? So it's a combination, you know, who's available, right? We don't have always the, you know, the person who's most readily available in that location with that expertise is the one we go to, and it could be private or public. And as Representative Hansen indicated, the source for the material for those private parties is mostly from private nurseries. The DNR nursery does have some capacity, but it's usually in the leftover mode when they've finished with the allocations to their state forest needs. And I'll let Director Bowe respond to that part of it.
Director Bowe.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, we do have the ability to serve private woodland owners. I think the big difference between us and Bowser and SWCD is really the size of maybe that woodland owner. I mean, we'll work with anybody. We both get a lot of initial calls. I think if people think about planting trees as a, you know, forested condition, they're probably calling DNR. They think about planting trees around their farm or their woodlot. You know, they're probably connecting with Bowser or someone that they've already worked on some other conservation practices with. And so, yes, for the EAB saplings, basically, these would all come from private nurseries. Probably want to think about connecting with the Minnesota Landscape Association to talk about capacity there, but those are not seedlings usually that a community plants. Those are much bigger than a seedling. The trees that Mr. Jashke is talking about are seedlings that are usually planted for a windbreak or like Mr. Jashke said, along riparian areas. And about half of our sales at the Bedora Nursery go to private landowners. And so about 50% we grow ourselves and use ourselves, and about the other half go to private landowners that buy directly from us. And we get a lot of the SWCDs buying seedlings from us and packaging them, along with other things that they've gotten from private growers.
Okay, thank you. That answers my Mr. Chair.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Yeah, that answers my question, that it's not just the taxpayer paying for groves and whatnot for agriculture communities. You know, when you have large groves and whatnot, it's a cost share, and that's certainly something that's reasonable, I guess, in my book. But I'm sure there's a call for it. I do probably want to make some clarity here. This storm we had last night, and we've talked about it in a couple of places now. It was a horrible storm, but I don't think it was just ash trees that went down. Is that fair to say? I don't know that for sure, but I will check out when I head up.
I think they were saying that the ash trees snap easier than some of the others, but
yeah.
I don't think anybody's done an inventory this morning.
No, I don't think so. No. In fact, fact of the matter is, when we're on that topic, does anybody have any idea? I was going to ask the gentleman from Met Council if he knew how many inches of rain we actually got, but I guess it varies for all over the area. So we probably should move on.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, I know that it flooded on Robert Street and Emerson just a short few blocks from your son there. So hope he wasn't out on the road when that happened.
But. No, I know he wasn't. No, cleaned it up nice, so I'll bet. Yeah, that's one nice thing about rains.
Representative Lippert, did you have another question for Director Bo or Director Jashke?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have another question for Director Jashke. Changing the subject to water storage, which is also related to this the storm and the rains that we had. So I don't know about the rain amounts in the cities. I was doing a little bit of looking, though. I know in Northfield we had 2 inches. Wilmer had 3. Just south of us in Northfield and Dodge County, there was a band that had over 5, which is increasingly typical now. So Director Jashke, we have a provision for some water storage, funding for water storage projects that would help water be held back on the landscape and infiltrate the soil. I wonder if you could just talk about what those projects might look like and how they might function after a significant rain event like we had last night.
Director Jashke.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, I was in Alexandria last night and got to see the storm and experience it there. And they got another one this morning. And, we had to stop on the freeway to be safe. But, what happens is the water, when it comes to that intensity, right? I mean, it wasn't like this was rain that occurred over 2 days. It was rain that occurred over a few hours. And that's the thing that we're seeing more of is the intensity of these rainfalls, right? Where they get a lot of water in a very short period of time. And of course, it has to go somewhere, and if it doesn't have anywhere to go or be held, it will just gush downstream, right? And it causes infrastructure damage, it can cause natural resources damage, like stream channels and things like that that get degraded, right? And so what we try and do is find places where we can hold that water without causing harm, right? And you can do it in long-term ways, with wetland restorations and projects that will also provide some habitat benefit. We can also do it in short-term duration where we have temporary water that can be held sometimes, along a road right of way to temporarily just allow that water to sit there and meter itself out. We can do that even in small ways along ditch systems with side inlets where the water, instead of gushing over to the bank, will go into a little area where the pipe intakes that water and discharges it into the ditch, more slowly, right? And so all of those things put together allow us to reduce the rate of the water. The volume, of course, is fixed. We just move the water across the landscape a little slower, which then prevents the water from biting so quickly and causing infrastructure damage or rushing so quickly in the stream and tearing out the banks. So that's a couple of ways we do that. We can also do it, as you mentioned, through infiltration, and that happens a lot in the urban areas. We try and hold the water by putting it in the soil that will absorb it and then discharge it into the groundwater if that's appropriate, or ultimately into the surface water as well. So a lot of ways to do it. In places where we've seen additional storms, we often have hydrology that's been modified too, with important infrastructure such as tile lines and ditches and and other means to pull that water, or parking lots, pull that water off the area where it's going to cause harm and get it to a place where it won't. But we got to have a place to put it where it'll be, you know, not causing the harm. So lots of different settings, lots of different practices, well proven again, standard specs that have been developed through USDA and through the stormwater, state stormwater manual. There's lots of good information there about how to do this. It's just a matter of doing more of it.
Sam Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Director Jaski. Now there's a difference between flood control structures and water storage structures, and sometimes I think those get confused. Could you just make that distinction for us so we're clear on what we're discussing right now?
Director Jaski.
Mr. Chair, members, I'll give you a simple explanation. In my opinion, flood protection can be done in a couple of ways. You can keep the water from harming the infrastructure, or you can harm the infrastructure to be not harmed by the water, right? And we've got the flood walls, we've got retention basins that prevent flooding. We've moved structures out of floodplains, for example, to prevent them from being harmed. Water storage is more about protecting the channel itself and the downstream area. And so it's about, and it can provide some flood benefits too. Certainly, we've seen that in a couple of examples that I'm aware of in the city of Austin. And so they've been very attentive to holding water in the upstream areas so that we don't have to have it flush through the city and cause damage to the infrastructure. So it does have some of that as well. But we have to do both, right? You can't just do one or the other because it just won't accomplish the goal. We have to hold water in the upper parts of the watershed and typically protect the flooding and the infrastructure in the more downstream developed parts of the watershed.
Tim Lippert.
That's, thank you, Mr. Chair. That's helpful, Director Jaski. It's a helpful distinction. And I'll just share part of the reason that I'm very interested in this provision. So I'm in Northfield. We've had 500 to 500 year floods since 2010 around the Cannon River. Now, fortunately, the heaviest rain, I think, fell in a different watershed, didn't fall in the Cannon River watershed. But what we need to be doing here in Northfield is having more water held back on the landscape, just to slow it down so it doesn't come through so fast. And that's a key thing we would like to see done to mitigate flooding. And it's key for other communities across the state too. So I just wanted to ask you about the water storage provisions, just highlight some of that. I think it's, we saw last night that these projects would be very helpful.
Senator Ingebrigtsen. Oh, sorry, Director
Jaski. I was just going to mention one last thing. I'll obviously take the questions, but this is also one of the provisions that has the opportunity for some federal dollars that have been made available for this kind of work, right? And so we've got draft applications ready to seek those federal dollars, and compete with other states to get those dollars. And there are a couple of different USDA programs, RCPP and 566, if we want some specifics. So we're going to make sure we not only would use Minnesota's money to the utmost, but try and bring some federal money to Minnesota to do even more.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Mr. Chair, not a question, I guess, just a question of procedure here. What can you give me the Ms. Taylor or Mr. Stanley, the reference we're talking about here in the side-by-side?
Ms. Taylor and Mr. Stanley.
Mr. Chair, members, are we talking about the water storage and management project appropriation? If so, that's on R19, the top of the page, that paragraph A, 1621 through 1633.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Senator Ingebrigtsen, anything else there?
No.
Representative Lippert?
Go ahead, Mr. Chair.
So, Director Jaski, and this might be a little bit related, the water storage, do you have people signed up ready to go on that? Or I know we had some money last year just on that, and maybe when you ask that, after you answer that question on CREP or other programs that, we have funded in the biennium, but how is demand out there for these soil and water conservation practices?
Mr. Chair, on the water storage, as you noted, we have a small amount of money that was appropriated last year, and we have an RFP that's out right now for that very purpose, and we're probably only going to be able to do about 3 projects, I'm guessing, with the dollars that are available. We didn't want to put out an RFP for a bigger, you know, number until we first have something. And so what we have seen, you know, great interest in this, but, you know, and focused largely in Minnesota River and the lower Mississippi. I expect other areas may also find interest in this at some point in time. When it comes to the CREP CREP program, that's another line item in the outside. That is a federal and state agreement that's been in place now for about 5 years, and that would be sort of an automatic federal contribution if we come up with additional state dollars to restore wetlands and protect drinking water supply areas. Again, restoring grasslands and wetlands is the biggest part of that. As far as demand goes there, we've stopped taking applications because we've utilized all of the state dollars that we've been allocated thus far. The Soil and Water Conservation District, of course, work with landowners to find those marginal pieces of land that could be restored and put back into the conservation practice for that purpose. And so I don't have a backlog only because we don't want to ask people for something that we can't do. I mean, as soon as we have the dollars, then we go out and seek the applications. And thus far, for the last 5 years, we've always had more demand than we had dollars to allocate to projects.
And Director Jashke, I may not have heard you. You only had 3 water storage projects. Is that? Or?
No, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. We're doing RFP, but we would only expect to probably fund about 3 of them, depending on the size, of course. But that's kind of the likely aim at this point. We would expect to have much more interest in that, but we haven't seen that RFP yet completed. So I just want to give you a status report, really, is all.
Representative Lippert, I jumped in on you there. Representative Lippert.
No, Mr. Chair, that was fine. I was, those are my questions on water storage, but would be interested in asking Director Jashke some questions related to soil health, too.
Director Jashke.
Yeah, happy to do so.
And maybe thank before you, that, Ms. Taylor, if you can find the soil health provisions in the bill. So I anticipated your question, Senator Ingebrigtsen, so. We can find that before Representative.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair and members, one of the sections is Section 38 in Article 2, starting on R71 through 72. It's the Soil Health Cost Share Program. And there's also on R70, there's also Section 36, which establishes some soil health goals.
Thank you.
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Jashke, I'm wondering if we could just begin by level setting a little bit. Can you speak to when we think about cover crops as a practice, there's a lot of conversation about cover crops, the percentage of farmland in Minnesota that's covered by cover crops. And if you know that percentage, and then if there are other states that are doing this better than Minnesota is right now.
Dr. Jashke.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lippert, I don't have an exact number for Minnesota where the USDA report that was last updated in 2017, it should be updated again sometime this year, that indicated somewhere in the neighborhood of, you know, 5%, maybe a little more, a little less. You know, as in comparison to other states, I you know, the difference right now is that we have more of that practice being implemented in states that are, you know, south of Minnesota, I would say the warmer states, right, particularly in the Corn Belt. You know, we've seen a lot of interest. The good news was in that report that I just mentioned that the increase in adoption had been, you know, in the 30 or 40% range, right? So we're seeing a positive trend, but we've got a long way to go, I think, is probably the quick way to summarize that. What we've seen is that the landowners, the producers, the farmers that are, you know, interested in this, you know, they need a couple of things. One, they need to learn from somebody that they trust, whether that's a local agronomist or a stormwater conservation district expert, or frankly, their their neighbors or their peers, other farmers who are doing it, right? It's got to be integrated into their business. And once they understand that, into their cropping system and their soil types and the topography, right, all of those things come into play, then they try it, right? And then they try it, you know, for a few years. You can't just typically do it once, although sometimes that's enough. They integrate that into their equipment planning, right? Because these things take special equipment to plant and to otherwise manage. They see gains, you know, over time in the soil health in terms of productivity in the soil. You also realize some savings in terms of inputs, right? Because you don't have the same amount of equipment passes and fuel costs and in some cases even fertilizer inputs, right? So there's an accumulation of benefit that takes time, and it takes an understanding of how to put this into practice, you know, kind of field by field, person by person, right? So that's what this is about. And again, as is the case with all of these endeavors that are being proposed here, there's a cost-sharing component to it. The landowner puts in their piece, and the conservation practice puts in its part, and the technical assistance aspect that has to go with it in all cases. And again, we are using every bit of our resources to seek the federal complementary dollars in this case and the other ones as well.
And Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for that, Director Jashke. So, you know, what you're sharing is very consistent with what I'm hearing from farmers locally and across the state, that more and more farmers are really interested in implementing these practices, experimenting with them. More are doing so, but there are a couple things that are needed. One is some financial assistance. The cost share program seeks to address that. And the other is technical support too. And I just wanted to ask you this question as well. So as I drive from Northfield to St. Paul, right now I see a few fields that have cover crop on them that are green. Most everything else is bare soil right now. And so, you know, what would it be the difference in what's happened to the soil with a 2 or 3 inch rain like we had last night with a cover cropped field versus a field that's bare at this time of year?
Director Jashke.
Chairman, Representative Lippert, yeah, certainly the living cover, or even, you know, in the case of no-till, you know, just the detritus that would be left over from the prior year's planting and harvest can be very beneficial to hold the soil together, right? And farmers want to keep the soil on the field. Like, that's what gives them the nutrients and the productivity that their crops are going to need, right? And so some cover crops, as long as you're describing, have probably been applied in the fall after harvest. There's others now with different equipment that can actually be planted like between the corn rows, so that the cover ends up being there when the corn is harvested. There's different techniques, different cropping systems demand different approaches, right? If you go up in the River Valley, you know, you've got the sugar beet field, which are taking a different approach because, you know, you harvest those in the fall and you have to sit in the field for a while and so forth. So what you're seeing is any cover. Living cover is the best, in those shoulder seasons in the fall and the spring. Of course, in the spring, then when they get ready to plant, if it's just a pure cover crop, they will go in and typically knock that down with, typically a chemical to remove that cover crop so that the commodity crop can have a chance to fully grow right from the start.
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll just close with a comment that, you know, I think the $5 million that we have in this bill for support for cost share is something that farmers would be eager to put to use. And also that protecting our soil in this way is something that's very beneficial. So I just want to thank Director Jashke for the information. Just want to highlight that provision.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director Jashke, for being here. I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about lawns to legumes. We understand the program has been very popular that Bowser has administered, and the program was started to help bolster our precipitously declining pollinator populations. And I'm wondering if you could speak to a couple of things about the program. One, if you could speak to how it benefits pollinators versus traditional turf grass, and then also the popularity of it. I'm curious what you attribute that. If you could speak to the demand. The House does have provisions to continue the program because we understand that there's been just an incredible response to it. And I believe that we've kind of used up our resources, and Minnesotans are very enthusiastic about replacing their traditional turf lawns. So if you could speak to how it's working, the demand and the need, that would be fantastic.
Dr. Jashke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Morrison. Yes, the way that works is that we have two components of it. I think the way we call that is one is a community approach where cities typically or some small parts of cities would be doing neighborhood approaches to this, where they would organize neighbors to put in pollinator species, that are going to replace parts of lawns, right? No one's taking up all of their lawn typically. It's doing it in increments, right? Which makes a lot more sense from a landowner understanding and accomplishment and maintenance of these things, right? So you take a piece of the lawn, turn it into a pollinator area. We've also, in some of these cases, done it through community groups, that cities are organized, and using some of the boulevards and things like that also for these patches, really what they are, pollinator patches. We've had, I think the demand for it is, of course, we have several thousand on a waiting list to do this, right? And I think it's because people feel like they can do something for themselves for all of Minnesota, right? When you put in pollinator-friendly species, it helps all the other species, right? That's kind of how that ecosystem works. We've targeted a bit to the rusty patch bumblebee area because that's a species that is in decline, so it's in decline. We haven't had any way to track the results of that yet. I mean, that may not be real simple to do. The University of Minnesota has been doing a great deal of work in understanding that, the patterns of the pollinator species movement, I guess, across the landscape. I'm not an expert in that, so you wouldn't be able to get a good answer out of me, but maybe one of them could be more of the scientific results from it. But from the program implementation, we've seen a great deal of demand. We've had the private sector greatly involved in providing the material, as well as Metro Booms, a private sector organization, using their technical expertise to help people do it right. And the 10 workshops that we've organized, so when people get the chance to do this, they're going to make sure they do it right the first time and know how to take care of it for the long run.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Director Jaski. So did I hear you say that there are several thousand people on the waiting list for this voluntary program? I want to make sure that's clear to people that this program obviously is entirely voluntary.
Director Jaski?
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct. And all these programs I've been talking about are voluntary, including ones. So I agree with them. Yes, there are several thousand people on the waiting list.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Director, if you could speak briefly to the other benefits of transitioning traditional lawns into pollinator-friendly habitats with native plant species, in addition to, because my understanding is there are benefits above and beyond protecting pollinator populations.
Director Jashke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morrison, yes. And, certainly that's an area you don't have to mow, so there's less energy and fuel used for that purpose. There's, turf grass isn't bad for absorbing a rainfall if the soil is properly, cared for, but, a natural landscape is going to be even better, right? Because it'll capture the rainfall, pull it into the root systems, of course, attenuate the intensity of the raindrops, things like that, right? So we always see the water quality benefit as well that comes from it. Again, the university might have more data collection that they could speak to about the individual species that benefit them. I'm not a botanist or a biologist that could do that. So I would say that those other benefits of water quality for sure are part of it, and the energy savings too, where you don't have to use energy to remove it more along.
Any other questions for Director Jashke?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ingebrigts, and then we'll go to Representative Wasley.
Mr. Chair, can you, to Mr. Jashke, about how much per acre does the state of Minnesota appropriate to lawns to legumes. What does it come out to about per acre?
Director Tashke.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, they don't have a per acre number, but it's a $300 cost sharing agreement with the landowner. So it's a very small amount, and it's usually over, you know, a fairly small area. So that's a, you know, a good thing, because we need to keep a good ratio of the landowner and the private parties' ownership in these practices, right? Because if they own it, then they will take care of it and do it the right way. And they have to attend the workshop. I can maybe see if I can get you more information about converting that to a per acre basis, but it's a $300 cap, I guess, on the cost sharing component.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
No, thanks, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wasilek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not a question, just a comment. I think one of the things that I've heard about lawns to legumes is that it's also raising awareness about the importance of these pollinator-friendly environments. My parents, for example, planted some wildflowers in their yard randomly one year, and they've been coming back, and they've had a ton of pollinators showing up more than they've seen before. And I keep telling them, like, you should plant your whole yard so you don't have to mow the grass, and you can use this program to help you fund it. But I think that's another piece, is that people seem to be more aware of this. I think lawns to legumes have really helped that. The popularity of the program, the number of people who participate and want to participate, I think is raising awareness about why this is important, and how, you know, again, it goes back to that, how can individuals help? I think people are understanding what's going on with our pollinators, are seeing some of the issues with honeybees and other sorts of bees here and across the country, and really want to do what they can to support that. And, you know, not everybody can be a beekeeper, but, you know, people can plant things on their property that will help pollinators. And I think it's just been, that's another piece that I wanted to highlight, is just the awareness that it's raising around the state. And particularly, I think, in the suburbs, where folks have, you know, smaller areas of this land, but they want to do something to help their communities and the pollinators. So just wanted to point that out as well. Thank you.
Director Tashke.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Chairman, Representative Wildwood. Yeah, and that's where, you know, the training part of this was always something that we wanted to do. We figured out a way to do it, because, you know, once people go through the training and they get this small amount of cost sharing and with their own money, then that's a start. And then they know what to do and continue it themselves, right? And talk to other people about it too, which, you know, the word of mouth is, it's like I was saying with the soil health practices in the farming community, you know, people trust other farmers to know how to manage their land and make sure their business is running well, and so they're going to listen to them as well as anybody else. And the same is true in the lawn conversion. They're going to listen to somebody who's done it before and say, oh, you can do it, I can do it too, right? So that is an important part of it. It's getting people to see it for themselves and then hopefully take some action.
And Director Tashke, there are people who are not taking any money. They just want the technical assistance, correct?
And Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct. We've got people, we open the workshops to people who want to come, even if they want to do it on their own. The requirement for the workshop is if they're going to get the cost sharing, so they can make sure the dollars are well spent.
Maybe we should get the list of upcoming workshops to share with the committee, so after session is done.
Sure.
Members, any other questions for Director Tashke? Thank you. We have some questions for the PCA. Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, I'd like to ask some questions related to peatlands. And maybe staff could just point to the peatlands related provisions in the bill.
Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, it'll just take me a minute to find those. I believe there's a goal, and then I believe there might be some appropriations too. If Mr. Hagemeyer can point on any appropriations, I'll look for the goal.
Mr. Hagemeyer, are you looking for the appropriations too?
Mr. Chair, yes, I'm looking for what I can provide.
Mr. Chair.
Oh. I'm Lippert.
I think the appropriations for voluntary enrollment for CREP for Peatlands is in Legacy, not in this bill.
Okay. Peatlands goal is in this bill.
Peatlands goal is in this bill. So the policy. but Ms. not
Taylor.
Appropriation.
Mr. Chair and members, the peak soil goal can be found on R56, section 7 on the House side. And that'd be Article 2.
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if Ms. Claflin of the PCA is available.
Welcome, Ms. Claflin. Welcome back to the House. State your name and who you're with for the record.
Thank you, Chair Hansen, Representative Lippert. I'm Ann Claflin with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Claflin. So good to see you. Glad you're with us. So I read a very powerful article from the Star Tribune about peatlands and their place, drain peat soils and their place in greenhouse gas emissions in the state of Minnesota. And I wonder if you could say a little bit about, just provide some background on drain peatlands and why they emit greenhouse gas emissions and where they fit in greenhouse among greenhouse gas emitters in the state of Minnesota.
Ms. Claflin.
Chair Hansen, Representative Lippert. The drained peatlands are a significant source of greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota. We often think of fossil fuels, but a number of emissions do come from agricultural practices. And these drained peatlands are a large source of carbon dioxide and nitrous oxide emissions. They make up anywhere from 340 to 800, 900,000 acres in Minnesota. The actual acreage is a little bit uncertain, but in any case, it's about 1.5 to 3% of the total acres of agricultural land in Minnesota. But those acres emit 3% to 6% of our total greenhouse gas emissions in the state. Those emissions are generated by the drying of the soil, which allows microbes to come in and start to decompose all the rich carbon material that's in the soil, releasing that carbon dioxide, some of the nitrogen components as well. So draining those soils is a large source of greenhouse gas emissions.
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I believe in the Star Tribune article, it was, according to the MPCA ranking, it had drained peat soils as like fourth on the list among emitters of carbon in the state. Is that correct?
Ms. Claflin.
Chair and Representative Lippert. Yes, depending on how you lump and group different sources of emissions, those cultivated histosols, is what we're calling the peatlands that are farmed for agriculture, are a very large source, about 11 million tons of greenhouse gas emissions, which is about fourth in ranking behind the total emissions from natural gas, coal, and light-duty trucks, so petroleum in light-duty trucks.
I'm Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Claflin, so in your view, I've heard this from some others, but in your view, is any effort to protect, restore, enhance peatlands kind of a good bang for your buck sort of strategy related to climate solutions, especially natural climate solutions?
Ms. Claflin.
Chair and Representative Lippert, yes. Conserving the peatlands that we have, restoring peatlands that have been taken out of agricultural practice, but may still have drainage in place, are very strong drivers of reducing our greenhouse gas emissions or preserving that carbon sequestration It would really help us reduce our emissions and achieve some of our climate change greenhouse gas reduction goals. Of course, any policy has some acres that would be more efficient to conserve or restore, but it's a very valuable source of carbon that we should work on preserving so that doesn't get released into our atmosphere and add to our greenhouse gas emissions.
Representative Lippert.
Thanks, Ms. Claflin, for that explanation. That's very helpful. So on the House side, just a comment from here, Mr. Chair. So on the House side, we have goals in place to protect, enhance, and restore 25% of drained peatlands in Minnesota by 2030, 50% by 2040. And in an effort to just get to some of that low-hanging fruit related to peatlands, I think it's peatlands are a great opportunity for us to make some gains related to climate change. I expect there are some landowners who are having difficulty draining this this soil. It's can be difficult to manage. And so we, as I mentioned a little earlier, we have some money for voluntary enrollment for CREP for peatlands in the legacy bill, so that if farmers want to set some land aside, they can do that. And also in this bill related to CREP, we have funds for CREP, but also the Bowser is free to be able to provide some more environmental value or give a higher value to land that has a strong environmental value, and peatlands could fit into that as well. But I think this is, both planting trees, dealing with peatlands, and then soil health, which is dealing with resiliency for our soils. Some of these practices, soil health practices, also sequester carbon. All of these pieces, Mr. Chair, that are on the House side are climate strategies for us that also have many other benefits for our state. And I think it's a good use of one-time dollars that we have for this state surplus right now. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Mr. Chair, I did just have the number pulled up for the legacy bill. I'm sorry, I was trying to. Representative Lippert was correct. It was out of the legacy funds. I was just trying to pull it up before. It was carried in the bill that you carried, Mr. Chair, House File 4377, and then that passed the legacy in the House side, and it was included in House File 3438. There's specifically $7.665 million for Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program for peatlands, and then there's also $7.665 for the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program.
And maybe just to get on the record, if Director Jashti's here, those are easement programs. They are not acquisition programs. So the landowner retains the private interest and pays the taxes. There's no HILT obligation or public land purchase there. Is that correct, Director Jashti?
Mr. Chairman, yes, conservation easements are reinvesting the full Minnesota program, which from the foundation or the program and other eligible conservation easements are privately held, and those landowners are paying the taxes as they have been and continue to do.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Jashti. Obviously this will be taking some cropland out of production. Is that something that's is that done quite frequently with regards to the peatland issue that is in the House bill? Would you be taking or encouraging farmers to go ahead and do that? I guess they have all the right in the world to do that, but are they going to be cutting down on crop production?
Director Jashti.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, the peatland thing would be new, so I can't speak to the experience there. I mean, there are some peat areas that have been farmed, in northern metro and other places. But what we're always seeking in any of these conservation programs, they're aiming at the marginal land, like the land that's not being productive, right? So that would be the case under this program as well. So there could be some money conversion, but we never take, of course, the whole thing. We just take a portion of the most marginal land, which has the good news is it provides the most environmental benefit at the lowest cost, and because that land is the least valuable for that other purpose or that previously been in. So That's a pretty general answer. I wish I could give you a better one, but that's, I'd be happy to do so if we had a more site-specific question.
Thank you.
Senator Ingebrigtsen. Any other questions for Ms. Claflin or Director Jashke? Members, I told Senator Ingebrigtsen we'd kind of wrap up by three. I have some questions for the PCA and on a couple additional items, and want to make sure if other members have questions that we get those in. Ms. Taylor, could you find on the in the bill the Pig's Eye Task Force, and maybe Mr. Hagemeyer, the Pig's Eye appropriation?
Mr. Chair. You want me to go? I'll go first quickly. In Article 1 on page R5, there's pay on the House side, line 5.1, there's $1.8 million to address Pig's Eye Landfill, of which $800,000 is for the task force and $1 million is for the preliminary assessment and cleanup.
Ms. Taylor?
Mr. Chair and members, the task force language can be found on R101, Article 2, and it's Section 87.
Mr. Kudelka? Director or Commissioner Kudelka, are you on?
Chair and committee members, I am. I just
got could you maybe describe the Pig's Eye site and the threat, and then what a task force would do in bringing together, just your working with the alphabet soup of agencies, what the view of the PCA is? Mm-hmm. Director Kudelka.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Kirk Adelka. I'm an assistant commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and work on land issues. So Pig's Eye Dump is located in St. Paul, right next to the airport and Pig's Eye Lake. And also in that neighborhood is the wood waste location for the St. Paul Cogen facility. It is a old dump site. We refer to it as a dump is because it really did start before we started permitting areas. So it's an unlined area where trash and garbage was deposited for a number of years. And we have issues there where we have contamination that is seeping into the groundwater and flows into Battle Creek, which runs right through the middle of the dump and eventually to to Pig's Eye Lake. The issue of drinking water risks to surrounding communities, we do not see that. We see more of an ecological risk to the creek and to the lake. There was extensive work done out there to remove physical hazards and put on a cap to try to prevent rainwater from going into the waste and carrying it even more through the groundwater. And along parts of the creek, a selective fill, kind of as a filter that would prevent, in some areas, contamination moving through into the creek. There still needs to be more work done there, and we're in the midst of a feasibility study to look at various options, including looking at additional select fill along there to protect the creek. But also now, because of contaminants are emerging concern and contaminants that have emerged, such as PFAS, 1,4-dioxin, we're doing more investigation in that area. And so we've been doing this work under MLCAT, the Metropolitan Landfill Contingency Action Trust is one of the sites that is eligible there. And in the next couple of years, we're looking to do additional investigation and wrap up our feasibility plan. But as we're looking to do the protection there for human health and the environment, there's also other conversations going on about what can this property be used. The community, whether it's the city, county, neighborhoods, and that are also looking at it as a natural resource benefit and a park. And so while our work at the MPCA has focused on the cleanup efforts, there does need to be a larger effort for what the future of the property looks like. When we do our remediation work, we have to make sure our efforts match the intended use, current use, and what we know of the potential future use. And so the task force, the idea that's been brought forward by various members, would help coordinate that work. While we will lead the work needed to be done for the remediation and cleanup, this really would pull together a number of agencies and create a unifying plan for not only the restoration for natural resources and what the vision is for a park in that, but also the cleanup efforts. So they meld together. What I would compare this to is the work that's been done in Duluth and the St. Louis River area of concern, where we're dealing with remediation of contaminated sites at the same time natural resources restoration and other improvements for the general population and the community there. And so the task force we see could provide something that's been missing in the area of Pig's Eye and bring the agencies together and create that uniform vision and plan.
Director Kadelka, because it's in the Mississippi River, we've got Army Corps, Park Service, federal agencies, state agencies, counties, cities, Metropolitan Council, Waste Control Commission. I mean, does the agency see a value of at least having some formalized method of bringing them together?
Mr. Chair and committee members, we do. I think it would provide us that goal and resources to be able to move forward and bring in a facilitator to do this. Each of our agencies have our own aspect of it, and I believe we're all doing that, but it really does need those additional resources to bring it together and meld those various efforts.
Senator Ingebrigtsen. Hope you're muted, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you. I'm sorry about that. With comparison to the House side appropriation, I'm sure you're well aware that and maybe it's in the House LCCMR, but I think the Senate portion of the LCCMR has about $800,000 for the same project. So I just wanted to put that out. Thank you.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, I think that was Senator Herr's bill, maybe in the Senate. So I know when I came over there this morning, he asked me about it right away. So
yeah,
I want to give him acknowledgement and Representative John. Director Kadelka, Commissioner Kadelka, you mentioned MLCAT, and that's a big item in this. I'm going to ask you about that, but I want to have Mr. Hagemeyer point out the appropriations for MLCAT.
Sure, Mr. Karadevi, on the Article 1 side-by-side on page R10, the top on the House side, lines 9.22, there's a transfer section. There's $29,055,000 transferred from the general fund to the MLCAT account for the repayments intended under the laws of 2003 and 2005. And that includes the estimated lost investment income.
Thank you. And Senator Ingebrigtsen, I think one of the accomplishments we had in the very first conference committee we were in was to ask the agency to do a report on this. And they provided that 40 plus page report a couple of years ago now. And, you know, I would certainly like to get this completed. Commissioner Kadelka, how did the agency determine, first off, what was the amount that was taken from the fund and with a promise to be repaid? And then how was the interest calculated? Commissioner Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the account was used a few times, and I'll just do a brief history on that real quick here. In 2003, $9.9 million was taken from the MLCAT to the general fund for various uses, with a generic statement saying it was the intent to restore these funds when available. And then in 2005, $4 million was removed from MLCAT for the renewable development account. Both of those had those statements where the intent of the legislature was to restore those funds to the account, but were not, those things were not done. So that is $13.9 million. And then in 2015, $8.1 million was removed from the account to the general fund, but that was paid back later that year because of language that said if there was a surplus available, that would go back into the account. And so those are the dollar amounts that were removed from the account and have not at this point been repaid. Although there is the language from last conference committee for a small amount, I believe $100,000 each year to help repay that at some time distance into the future. one of the things that we were asked for was, what would it look like? What was the lost revenue that was potentially gained? So we did an exercise where we looked at if these dollars were invested in the State Board of Investment over the since 2017, when that was something that could be done, what would have been the lost earnings? And that's where you see the principal and the lost earnings equals $29 million of what was would have been in the account if it had not been removed from the account back in the 2000s.
Thank you. And Senator Ingebrigtsen.
So, Mr. Kudelka, you said it was replaced a fairly significant amount here a few years back. How much was that? That amount in 2000, I think, 15, you said.
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, in 2015, it was $8.1 million that was removed from the account, transferred out. And then later that year, when there was a positive balance in a surplus, the law said that, you know, with that November forecast, it would be repaid back. So $8.1 million was repaid back for that.
$8.1 million in, $8.1 million out, $8.1 million in.
Correct.
That the early 2000s was never paid back.
Correct.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Yeah, no, that's, I've got it now. Thanks.
And Commissioner Kudelka, how many sites besides the Pig's Eye Dump are eligible to task this fund?
Chair and committee members, there are a number. Pig's Eye is specifically written into the legislation, but there are four old closed C&D construction demo landfills that accepted some mixed municipal waste that are eligible, and the agency is doing work there for investigation. Many of these are now in developed areas. And then also the two existing municipal landfills in both of them in Dakota County, if for some reason the company themselves are not able to take care of after closure, the facilities after their contingency dollars aren't there for some reason, or they run out, this fund would be able to cover those two landfills also. So a total of seven landfills at this time.
So Senator Ingebrigtsen, Pig's Eye alone will probably drain this fund. Is it to this point, Representative Wasilick, or I think Senator Ingebrigtsen was, so I'm just Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you. Real quickly to this point, just a question. If you're planning on paying back Milcat, why do they need appropriation for Pig's Eye? I'm not quite understanding in this bill.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, precisely because of the thing that Commissioner Kudelka just mentioned, there are multiple sites and the Pig's Eye work needs to continue. So you need that additional funding because you've multiple sites that are supposed to be covered by MLCAT. Do you understand what I'm saying? There's Pig's Eye work is critical. And if we have to fund the, there's only $13 million in the MLCAT right now, if I'm correct, Commissioner Kudelka. So restoring it covers the seven sites and then that additional work that could begin right now on the additional funding.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. My only point is if your bill is going to replenish that account, then you wouldn't need the Pig's Eye appropriation. Mr. Kudelka, can you tell me how the freeway landfill project is going? I know you and I and Representative Hansen have been working on that for quite some time here. I'm not very good at timing, but I'm thinking at least in the last 8 years. Has that been completed or where is that sitting?
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Freeway Landfill is a closed landfill in our closed landfill program. We right now are wrapping up the technical work on the final design for that. We're looking to move forward two options to go out to bid. One of those be what we refer to as a dig in line, which is dig it up, build a liner right underneath it and pop it back down. Or the other is a dig and haul, dig it up and bring it to another lined facility. It is an unlined facility and there's risk to the Minnesota River and surrounding areas. That is one component. Last legislative session, the legislature passed some policy language that really strengthened the program for when we have unwilling and uncooperative landfills. And so that process is laid out in statute and some clarifications, which are moving us forward to try to get access to the property. We've been unable to get access to do the work that's envisioned in both of these plans. And so that legislation outlines a number of steps, and we are starting to, you know, see what that needs to be done in that area. Access is going to be the key part. It's the key issue right now, and we are working with our partners to chart a path forward with that, with the new legislation that was passed last year, thankfully from the legislature.
So, I don't want to belabor this because I know you have other questions. So are you moving forward with that legislation that we worked hard on to get last year to gain access on this property? I know that's been an issue for years. Is there some threat of litigation yet still from the property owner? When do you expect to be able to get on that property?
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we've been able to get on the property to investigation and to do that, but it's usually taken multiple legal conversations to have that, short of court actions. However, digging up the whole site is a much larger prospect. And so we are going through the steps there. It unfortunately is a time-consuming effort to make sure that we do the correct administrative processes, but we are moving forward in that area.
Thanks.
Anything else on that point, Senator?
No, nothing. It just seems to be taking forever times five to get that thing cleaned up. And we all know that that was one of the priorities some years ago. And I'm glad we're at least going in the right direction. Hopefully we'll get that figured out.
Representative Wasilek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to take the opportunity. This is a nice segue into some of the things that are in the House bill, House version of the bill that talk about waste and recycling and composting. And so I'm wondering, so there's a couple provisions. Article 2, pages 78 through 80, and then 80 through 83. There's the multifamily composting language and then the zero waste grants. And then Article 2, 117 to 119, so there's a couple sections in the House version of the bill. That has to do with, again, the multifamily composting, the zero waste grants, and then the labeling of compostable items. And I'm wondering if Commissioner Kudelka could talk a little bit about like how these pieces sort of fit into the MPCA's overall goals around waste reduction and composting. I know there's several sort of goals and plans that the agency has to try and reduce waste and to try and move forward with things like composting. I'm wondering, Mr. Commissioner Kudelka, if you could just comment on sort of the agency or the state's plans for this, and then how these pieces sort of fit into the plans that already exist.
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, a good question. There are a number of different proposals in the two bills that would help with solid waste. And I think just to kind of create the framework that you talked about, the legislature has put in statute what we refer to as the waste hierarchy, wanting to have waste prevention first because of the most environmental and human health benefits, then reuse and repair, and then recycling, composting, and then waste energy and disposal. And so the other part of this here too is the state has a number of things that it has the lead on. And there's also then the counties have planning and responsibilities also to implement it. And so that's where I'm gonna just talk about each of these proposals and how they fit in there. The first is the governor's proposal has a number of grant programs in it. And the first is on food waste prevention and rescue. And that is, it also included in the House bill, a portion of the dollars would go to that. And that's on that high end of the hierarchy, the most environmental benefit there. And it also provides additional issues when food can be rescued, it can help with food insecurity and other issues. And so that's how that piece fits into it. The second in the governor's proposal is market development. And for us to have a strong Minnesota recycling and compost system, we need to sell the product someplace. And Minnesota has done that in the past, and you may have read the recent announcement of plastic film, the luring of public and private entities working together to allure a company to Minnesota to take that plastic and make it into a new material. So that would be dollars to help there. The second would be also the efforts with composting and anaerobic digestion facility development. And the final is construction demo waste. And how do we do that same material? So that's in the governor's proposal, which is in the House's bill. The House also has the multifamily housing composting. And that fits in into that same piece where the governor's bill has the facilities where compost would go. The House bill has how do we collect it from people to bring it to those facilities. So they work in tandem on both sides of that spectrum where collecting more materials from a multifamily house to go in there. The last one, the zero waste provisions that we've talked to the author and others, has a lot of things that's in the governor's bill. But the one piece that doesn't is source reduction. And so we've been working with the author to really, and that really means how do we reduce waste from being created or how do we improve the repair industry here? And so that's how that kind of fits all in the framework. And the last piece is the Senate SCORE dollars and in the House tax bill, the SCORE grants, that's getting dollars to counties to implement those. So there's a package that's between the governor, the House, and the Senate to work on various aspects of the solid waste hierarchy and preferences.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is a point where we can have more conversations. It sounds like there's interest in solid waste and these issues among all of the stakeholders and negotiations. So maybe that's something we can talk more about. I did want to point out one of the other pieces about the labeling of compostable items, not just because it's my bill, but because I've heard some other people reaching out to me interested in that. But I think one of the things when we had hearings on this bill in the past that we heard was, this is not just for, this is for consumers, but also for composters. So making sure that the things that are listed as being compostable are actually compostable. So when these composters are having these compostable items, like they're actually contributing to the compost in a way that's helpful and not harming and contaminating that compost. And also that consumers understand. I know whenever I get, there's plastic packaging, there's other packaging that we get in various things. And I look at all the symbols on it and I really don't know. Like, it's not clear what those all mean and what's actually compostable. So I think that's another piece, another attempt to try and sort of bring us back to, consumers having some of that control and power over their purchasing decisions so that if they are people who compost, they sort of have more clarity around what's compostable. And it also helps composters too. So just wanted to highlight that piece as well. And again, I think it sounds like there's some, agreement possibly on some solid waste things. And if we can do something on that issue, I think it would be a good thing for us to be doing too. Thank you.
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we also support the PEC labeling for compostable items. This is one of the things, just like the funding pieces that we talked about earlier, is what we hear from local businesses and consumers. And so all these items are responding to those pieces. And I just want to highlight one part. It is the financial viability of these facilities. We talked about market development, but we also need that for compost facilities. And the Minnesota Compost Council has done a really good job of saying what those costs are, between $40,000 to $65,000 a year for just having to remove contaminated materials that's getting in their products. Contamination in their materials means they can't sell the compost. And then, just then having then to pay for that disposal of the materials that shouldn't be there, which what they don't want, could be savings up to $250,000 per facility per year. So this will help local businesses as they move forward and want to expand or continue to exist.
Thank you. Senator Ingebrigtsen, I think you have SCORE grants in your provision, and I think we have SCORE grants in the tax bill. So I don't know if Mr. Stanley or Mr. Hagemeyer could maybe talk about that cross-jurisdictional, where there are dollars for SCORE.
I believe there's 700 in there. Mr. Stanley or Mr. Hagemeyer?
Mr. Chair, members, good afternoon. Yes, if you look at the spreadsheet on line 45, you will see that the Senate adds 700 per year in base funding for SCORE grants. And Mr. Hagemeyer can chime in if I've said anything not in fiscal speak.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Stanley, that was great. It's on the Article 1 side by side on the Senate side. On page R2, line 3.1, the Senate is adding $700,000 per year from the Environmental Fund towards SCORE grants. I believe the base amount right now is $18.4 million, somewhere right in that range. I don't have it right in front of me at the moment. And Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I don't know what's included in the tax bill for SCORE grants.
Perhaps we can get that, Senator Ingebrigtsen, so, or you can talk to the tax chair. I think it's $3 million. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, I'm not either. No, that's something I can check on.
Any other questions for Commissioner Kadelka? I have one final topic area if nobody else has any questions. We've been talking about urgency and pests and diseases and trees going down and storms and climate and water, but we haven't talked about aquatic invasive species. And maybe if Ms. Taylor could find that provision in the House bill just to highlight that, because those pests keep coming as well, Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, I can take the appropriation part of it if you don't mind. On the Article 1 side by side, I'm starting on page R13 on the House language, would be 11.32, and then continuing on to page R14, there's $1.841 million from the general fund for grants to Lakes Association, local government units, and tribal governments to manage aquatic invasive species, including starry stonework.
And that's one time, Mr. Hagemeyer?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. That would be one time in addition to whatever was included in the base last year.
Thank you. Senator Ingebrigtsen, I don't know if our members have anything else or if your members do. I said we'd try to be done by 3 o'clock and we're a little bit shy of that. Tomorrow you would have the gavel, but we're not meeting and we're not meeting on Saturday and we're not meeting on Sunday. So you would have the gavel again on Monday. And I'm wondering if you've heard anything on joint parameters or possibilities or opportunities relating to funding.
You mean money? No, I have not. You and I had a conversation before the meeting, and I told you I would let you know that I have not had anything yet from leadership. So as far as moving forward on Monday, I think what I'll do is I'm going to discuss it with my committee. And I don't know that there's a whole lot more we could talk about. We're going to have to start moving forward, it seems to me. So maybe we can start the possibility of moving forward with amendments, if there are any. Hopefully by Monday we'll have an idea on dollars so we can start doing some proposals back and forth and get moving. So it's a little vague, but I guess everybody stay tuned. Jesse will set out an agenda and we'll also stay in contact with via phone, Mr. Chair, and talk about the upcoming meeting. So that's okay. All right.
Thank you. With that, have a great weekend, folks. Yep. We are adjourned.